So let me tell you at the outset what the model is that we're looking at. It's general relativity. Stress energy tensor is a minimally coupled scalar field. It's in spherical symmetry in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So the metric is of the usual spherically symmetric form. It's got two functions of r and t in there. The model has one local degree of freedom, which comes from the scalar field only if you fix all the gauges. The only degree of freedom is a scalar field because of Birkhoff's theorem. It turns out if you write down the equations either in the covariant form or in the canonical form, it's a pretty complicated 2D field theory, which comes from the 3 plus 1 Einstein equations. There are no known analytic collapse solutions that are asymptotically flat. So there's really nothing to look at here. There's exactly one solution known that's asymptotically conformally flat, but it's a bit pathological. Then the other types of solutions that are known are solutions where phi and the metric functions are functions of r over t, in other words, self-similar solutions. Now, beyond the scalar field, there are lots of other collapse models, VIDIAS, CGHS, variations. And the scalar field one is by far the richest, mainly because it allows for inflow and outflow. And the inflow and outflow of the scalar field is not just straightforward and simple. OK, so let me just summarize what the classical results are. And this is work in the early 90s. If you impose asymptotic flatness in this model, there are two classes of initial data. There's weak data. So when you send in the scalar field, which is sufficiently weak, what you get is there's no black hole formation, the long time fully coupled evolution. There's strong data when there's a black hole formation. And there's some classical work on this, which originated all the numerical work done by Choptuk earlier on. A lot of this work has been generalized to other cases. The two results here are due to Choptuk in 93. And I generalized this work with some other people, including cosmological constant. And essentially, it's a numerical simulation. And that's how we get at results in this. And that's the main classical thing. And the picture that goes with this is the following picture, which is, again, familiar to people in GR. This is the conformal diagram. And the reason I put this up after telling you about that is this is a confirmed picture for classical black hole formation. It is supported by hard calculations, unlike the picture I'm going to put up in a bit. So what this describes is essentially these lines here are matter infalling. This is the horizon. This is future null infinity, past null infinity, spatial infinity. There's this singularity. So the long time limit when a black hole forms, this is with the strong data, is a Schwarzschild black hole. So the important thing is this is a confirmed picture of how things form. Now, coming to the semi-classical picture, the usual diagram that's presented is this one. So this looks just like the other one if you block off this top part here. This is just what I showed you earlier. But it's extended, and the extension is just this part up here. Now, this is the conjectured picture that arises if you consider a scalar field on a Schwarzschild background and Hawking radiation. And this is the standard picture that's responsible for the information loss problem, which you can sort of see if you ask what is the state on slice sigma 1, slice sigma 2, or slice sigma 3. You find that slice sigma 3 doesn't access all of the space-time preceding it. And so one can go into this a bit more detail. But the essential point I want to make about this picture is that this part of it is completely conjectured. And in fact, it's untested. So what is wrong with this picture? The first point about the picture is that there is no computed metric for which this is the conformal diagram in 3 plus 1 dimensions. For special models, you can say a bit more, but not for the model that I just wrote down. The other issues with this is there's a classical singularity, which is still there. There's an event horizon, which is still there. And what we expect in quantum gravity is that there should be some form of singularity resolution, and the horizon should be fuzzy. And how these things arise, we're going to see in the model. The other main thing about this model is that in the semi-classical case, that picture comes from the following considerations. If this is time, that picture comes from sort of three little pieces of insight sort of put in. There's a semi-classical period where there's Hawking radiation going on, a black hole is sufficiently large, and it's treated as a Schwarzschild metric. So there's a left-hand side of Einstein's equations where the mass is treated as dependent on time. It's a quasi-static approximation, lots of Schwarzschild black holes until the black hole disappears. Then there's this quantum gravity region, and this is the unknown region. And in fact, it's the quantum gravity region that's supposed to provide initial conditions for the emergent semi-classical region. That was the extension I showed you on that last picture. So given that we don't know what's inside this middle period, we don't really know what's going on up here. And so just because Hawking drew that diagram doesn't mean we just accept it completely. We need to know what's going on here before we can ask what happens after it. Okay, what is the emergent semi-classical space-time? So this little sequence is exactly what that, where that picture comes from, with this big black hole, quantum gravity black hole in the middle there. And by black hole, I meant we don't know what's going on in that box. Okay, so what do we do? Well, as I pointed out, there are three things in that picture, three things in that picture that everyone should be wary of. The first thing is that the singularity is still present in that semi-classical diagram. The other thing that's present is, and we want to ask in a full quantum theory of gravity, or even in this model, can we get singularity avoidance, are curvature operators bounded in some way? The second feature that you saw in that semi-classical diagram is there was an event horizon sitting there. It's a big global classical object. And in the quantum gravity region, we don't expect anything like that. Rather, what we might expect is something like some sort of a test for quantum test for trapped surfaces, because the usual kind of test that used in numerical relativity is you evolve data from one slice to the next, and you scan the evolved data to see if it's got trapped surfaces. You evolve again, see if it's got trapped surfaces. So essentially, you're detecting an observable classically at each time slice. We want to do the same thing in the quantum evolution and see if you can define those operators and actually do the test. And finally, what is going to happen if we set up the quantum theory properly is everything's going to be unitary, and it may turn out that there's no evidence for that little piece you tack on in the semi-classical diagram. So what I'm going to show you is that there are curvature operators in that model you can construct which are bounded. There is a notion of horizon operators, very well defined, which act on states and can tell you information at the quantum gravity level about trapping. And there's explicit unitary evolution as well. Okay, so let me tell you how the model works. We're going to be working in a non-perturbative canonical formulation. So start with that metric and the Einstein equations, get a Hamiltonian formulation. We use the ADM variables to do that. And the ADM variables are spatial metric, it's conjugate momentum. But there's an action here, which is just GR coupled to scalar field. There's a diffeomorphism constraint. There's a Hamiltonian constraint. And when we reduce, this is full gravity, of course. I haven't imposed spherical symmetry. When you impose spherical symmetry, there are two functions in the metric, R and lambda, depend on R and T. There's a scalar field, PR, P lambda, P phi are the conjugate momenta. There's a reduced constraint, reduced Hamiltonian constraint when you impose the symmetry. And this is a spatial metric, so that's the Q, and there's a pi, D is conjugate to these variables lambda and r. So now the task is to try to quantize this. And it's never been done before. The closest thing that's been done before is CGHS. But CGHS is exactly solvable. This isn't. And CGHS is 1 plus 1. This is reduction from 3 plus 1. OK, so there are a number of things we do. Normally, when you look at a model like this, you can ask, well, do I do full gauge fixing and get a fully reduced Hamiltonian just describing phi, or a partial gauge fixing? So full would mean you fix a time gauge, you fix a radial gauge, and solve the constraints. Partial is you just fix a time gauge. This is the path we follow. The first path was first done by Unruh in the early 70s, mid-70s. And he found that the Hamiltonian you get is something you can't work with at all. If you do a partial, just time gauge fixing, we find we can get much further. So this is why take that system, work with the time gauge fixing. Then there's a reduced means spherical symmetry. Gauge fixed means a particular time gauge is fixed. So now what we end up with is the Hamiltonian constraint is gone. There's a diffeomorphism constraint, radial part. And only two variables left, r, which is a geometry variable, and phi, which is the scalar field and some surface term. And there's still one constraint left over, which is the radial diffeo constraint. OK, so let me just come to close to the end here. So our goal for quantizing is the following kind of a picture. What in numerical relativity's initial data, of course, translates to an initial state. The theta plus theta minus I've written here are the apparent horizon detectors. And it turns out that they're actually functions of the canonical coordinates and momenta. They're defined on a slice. There's an operator we can define just by quantizing this. And there are curvatures. We can define the curvature operator. And together with all this, what we need is a procedure for step-by-step evolution of an initial state. And of course, there's an issue of what initial state we pick. And I'll comment on that a little bit. And also how we detect when evolving a state, the state describes a black hole and when it doesn't. OK. So how much? 5 minutes, OK. OK, so this is a description of the quantization. Essentially, what we're doing is we're taking a lattice. The lattice is a set of radial points. This is a field theory where fields depend on r and t. So we take a set of points selected from the half line, the r. And the Hilbert space of the theory is such that A1, so this here, this green thing here is a state. It's a state on this lattice. A1 to An are excitations of the field R, which is the geometric field. B1 and Bn are real numbers. A's and B's are real numbers. B1 to Bn are real numbers, which describe excitations of the scalar field. So I've said that here. Now, the basic operators, the basic classical observables we use are the scalar field with a smearing function and a translation operator. On a lattice, you can only have a translation operator, not the momenta itself. So we have phi, an observable made of phi, an observable made of exponential of its conjugate momentum. The same with r. These satisfy this Poisson algebra. On this Hilbert space, we find a representation of this algebra with the following action. So we have phi f's act on these states like this. They're diagonal. U's are translations, so they shift field excitations. That's all. Very standard kind of thing you might expect in a lattice. And now, the main thing I won't go into that. Let me just talk about the following and then stop. Telling you where we are. It's got smudged. As I pointed out, these trapping operators are functions of the canonical variables, so you can convert them into operators. So we have a prescription for writing down these operators. And these two pictures sort of illustrate how they're going to be used. So we have these states, which are excitations of the radial, the geometry field, and the matter field at various points. So essentially, think of this as an array. one-dimensional array. And what we do is evolve that array using the Hamiltonian and then test compute the expectation value of theta plus in the evolved state, the expectation value of r in that evolved state, and ask, is there a location expectation value of r, which is really the radial position, does it go through zero anywhere? And how does theta minus as a function of r evolve? So these are two things that we can track the evolution of with as we evolve the state. This is exactly the test used in numerical relativity, except at the expectation value level, it's being used in the quantum gravity model. And as far as the states are concerned, well, initially one could start with a state that's peaked on solutions to the classical constraints and then evolve this as we proceed. So time step evolution in a discrete way, test for trapping, evolve, 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 and see what you get. So let me just stop there and tell you summary what we actually have so far. It is essentially a framework for explicit calculations in quantum gravity, at least in this model. And what we have so far is everything is set up and it's just ready to compute. We have to write code and evolve initial states. And this should fill in the gap between semi-classical to the full quantum gravity region to whatever, and that whatever is just going to emerge through computation. So I'll stop there.